I'm the National Field Organizer, which is a very weird name, but essentially just means that I work with all of our chapters to help them either get started if they're a group like you all who want to get something started in a place, or if they are an existing chapter trying to figure out how to help make their work go. So right now, like I said, there are 9 chapters across the country, and I work with all of them. I work most intensively with the chapters in the West Coast, because it's where I am. I'm based in Oakland. But right now, I'm in the middle of a tour seeing everybody. So that's been really great to see what we look like, who we are, what we're doing all across the country.
How many chapters do you say?
9. And I'll go into detail about them in a second. So the reason that I want to start talking about the prison industrial complex is that Critical Resistance is a group that does grassroots organizing locally to fight the prison industrial complex. We are abolitionists, and we are for abolishing the entire prison industrial complex. And I'll get into more of the details about that too. I know that sounds like a little heavy. So just as a point of clarification, we aren't an anti-prison group. We have kind of a bigger mission even than that. Some of our chapters work on prison things, some of them don't. Some of them work on housing, some of them work on policing, some of them work on courts. So I want to make sure that we talk about kind of what that means for us. So how many of you have heard the phrase prison industrial complex before? Okay. It's a big, long, complicated sounding thing that we use not because it's big and long and complicated sounding, but because I actually think that it does different work than saying the criminal justice system, for instance. Part of the reason that we use it is to talk about all of these intersecting interests, right? So there are governmental interests, and there are private interests, corporate, business, other kinds of private interests. And we find them intersecting around the work that we're most interested in doing is around using surveillance, policing, the court system, imprisonment to solve, so-called, what we see are really social, economic, political problems, okay? So what does that mean? That means, in some cases, up in San Francisco, near where I live, that rather than figuring out how to build a social safety net for people who don't have housing, who don't have a place to live, they continually criminalize being homeless. So they've recently passed a whole series of punitive measures, some legal and some just enforcement measures, that keep people from asking for money, right? Aggressive panhandling, they call it. But if you ask somebody, if you approach somebody, and they don't like the way that you're approaching them, that can be aggressive panhandling, right? Public camping is another one, right? And people, you know, cops will routinely do sweeps to see if people are staying out where they shouldn't be, right? So it's kind of different. What that also might look like is the kind of all of the putative measures that get attached to drug use, right? So we've seen kind of a whole score of those things. Whereby you can't get access, if in some cases, to welfare for the rest of your life if you've been convicted of a drug crime, right? That's just one example. And the reason that we talk about these kind of intersecting interests like that is that the government has a vested set of interests, right, in keeping people under control, in keeping people really relying on the state to offer them the things that they might want to provide, right? Safety, security, that kind of stuff, right? I think we can all agree that we would like our neighborhoods and our families to be safe, right? Industry, obviously, there's a lot of money to be made through this process. So where these things intersect is that the government says, okay, well, if we can put in enough punitive measures, that will make sure that we can keep people somewhat in line. We don't disrupt the status quo. We get to keep things like white supremacy, patriarchy, capitalism in place, right? And industry saying, yeah, excellent. And we get to build more prisons, and we get to sell more stuff inside, and we get to have cheaper labor inside. And that works great, right? If we keep cops and courts and prisons working, and we keep cops and courts and prisons working, we both benefit, right? Does that make sense when I say that we use it to solve these social, economic, political problems? Is that clear?
Yeah.
And that's why we use this big, long phrase, right? I don't think that the phrase criminal justice system adequately describes that, right? So what we really are talking about are the ways that these two things are mutually reliant, okay? So when I say prison industrial complex, you kind of always have to hold in your head, okay, cops, surveillance, courts, policing, imprisonment. Policing and cops, I guess I'm saying, right? And so, you know, really what we're talking about, if it's an easier way to think about it, are all the paths that lead somebody potentially to be locked in a cage for the rest of their life and or, you know, killed, right, at the end of that road. But all of the circumstances that lead up to that. So in some cases, we have some of our members who look at the foster care system, for instance, as a portion of the prison industrial complex. We have some of our members who look at the education system as a piece of that. And while it's a really, really broad thing to be fighting, we also think that it's a really interesting way to build coalitions, to bring people in who might not normally be interested in this issue, and to really kind of draw and show everybody that this is everybody's issue, right? Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So like I said, we do that in a couple different ways. And one of the things that the phrase prison industrial complex came out of was this conference from which we get our name and our mission. So in 1997, a group of people, mostly in the Bay Area, got together and started figuring out that they had all these interests in common and that they really wanted to talk about what they saw as a crisis around imprisonment, mostly, but also around policing, also around surveillance, also around immigration. And so they got together, and it was a group of prisoners and former prisoners and family members of people inside and family members of people coming home and students and lawyers and all kinds of different people got together and said, okay, what if we figure out a way to bring everybody together for one weekend, talk about what some of these issues are, and see if we can hammer out some of this stuff. So in 1998 in Berkeley, there was a big conference that happened. Do you guys know about that conference? Is there anybody who was actually there? Okay. The conference organizers hoped to get about 500 people to show up. 3,500 people showed up over the course of the weekend. And it was amazing. It was this setting in which people like would pass each other in the halls, and I can't believe how many times I heard the phrase, oh, I thought you were still locked up. Oh, I thought you were dead. Oh, you know what I mean? Like people really, the movement, there hadn't really been a movement, you know? Things had kind of disintegrated a little bit. Everybody was kind of doing their own thing, right? The work didn't stop, but the idea was that people had kind of receded to their own corners. And so it was this way that people could really get back together, get reconnected nationally, internationally around some of these issues. So one of the things that came out of that was the kind of popularization of this phrase, prison industrial complex, to really talk about this very complicated set of ideas and interests. Another thing that came out was a lot of people were really energized to go home and do their work. And so, the conference organizers had said, oh, we're going to plan a conference, and that's going to be it, and then we'll go back to the work that we've been doing, because they were all, you know, organizing at some level already. And they started to get calls. Oh, the conference is really great. Can you help us do this? Oh, we want to start a campaign doing this. And one of those kind of requests for help and information came from a group of people on the East Coast who said, yeah, that was great. We think we'd like to do something that reflects what's happening out here and to really talk strategy. So in 2001, a group of people put together Critical Resistance East with the support of the people from out here. And there was an East Coast conference. That was in New York City. And about 25 people turned out to that. 2,500 people, I'm sorry, turned out to that. And that kind of moved this discussion from we're in a crisis to let's start being strategic about how we deal with this crisis, where we live, where we organize. So about the time that all that stuff was happening, a group of people who had been working with the two sets of conference organizers in other ways with Critical Resistance said, all this stuff is going on, should we think about becoming an organization? So we had a meeting of people from all across the country who are somehow stakeholders in this thing, and we decided to become an organization. And we hammered out kind of what that would mean for us. And why we would want to do it, and all of that kind of stuff. And basically what came out of that that's most interesting for the chapters and for the idea of developing new chapters is are a couple things. One is that we decided that we would become a national organization, but we would not take up any national campaigns. We made a very intentional decision about that. And that came out of people really believing that the best strategic work around these issues, because they were so many and varied, came from local organizing, came from people who lived in places, who could identify what the problems were that they saw, where they lived, and also could develop local responses that made the most sense for where they lived, who their communities were. So, for instance, you know, the stuff that works best in New York doesn't necessarily work as well in Gainesville, right? So to really figure out, we share all these, you know, kind of general ideas. There is this big problem. How can we attack it from where we are? So we made a decision not to do any national campaigns. We also made a decision to make our chapters relatively autonomous. We were not going to have mandates come out. We decided to try to operate as non-hierarchically as possible and to work as collectively as possible. So there are no bosses in Critical Resistance. There are different leaders at different times depending on what the circumstances are, but there is no single leader, no single voice for this organization, which can be complicated sometimes, but it's something that we're very committed to structurally. So those are kind of the two big main things, and that everybody who joined us would have to go through a process to join Critical Resistance, and would have to commit to keeping a very hard line about our mission. And we'll go through what the mission is and all of that. So as it stands today, there are 9 chapters across the country. They are Los Angeles, Oakland, Sacramento, New Orleans, Atlanta, Florida, Washington, D.C., New York City, and New Haven. We had a test run in Sydney, Australia, and we mutually decided that we weren't able to give each other the kind of support we would like to. So we may try another international experiment another time. And they're a great group of people, and so we keep working with them, but not as a chapter. So each of the chapters does slightly different work. I did not anticipate quite so many of you, which is very exciting for me. But I brought some of our newsletters. We put out a newsletter about once a quarter. That's an internal document, which doesn't mean there's anything secret in it. Mostly just means we use a lot of shorthand, and we talk about things that most of the chapters know already. But it'll give you an idea of some of the work that's going on in some of the chapters if you're interested in that. So, like I said, the different chapters work on different things. So, for instance, everything from, the group in New York does political education with women in treatment and their kids. And they do that in order to develop a new wave of organizers and to really empower people who are most impacted by this. So it's a court-mandated program. One of the graduates is now an employee of Critical Resistance and started this program, so it was her way of kind of going back and helping to bring everybody else along. Our group in New Orleans is working on trying to do a community education project on grand juries, because the neighbors where they work found that a lot of people were going to testify in the grand jury and not coming back. So they wanted to make sure that people understood what their rights and obligations were under this specific kind of jury setup, and so they wanted to make sure nobody else got caught up. Out here, and if you have specific questions about any of the chapters, let me know, but I'm not going to talk about every single one of them. I'll tell you what's going on the West Coast. In Los Angeles, it's a fairly new chapter. They just had a film festival, I guess in the fall. And what they've been working on are two things. They're using the model from New York, and they're working now in a transitional housing program for women coming home from jails and prisons and doing political education and organizer training with them. And they're also doing some research right now about trying to close down a potential jail expansion in LA. LAPD wants to build a new cop shop, like main headquarters for themselves, and an expansion of a jail down there. And so they're fighting that. Oakland is the oldest chapter. They were a chapter before there were chapters. So they've been around for a while, and they're kind of up and running in a different way. And they're probably the group that people know most about because they've been around a long time. They have a bunch of stuff going on right now. They have a monthly radio program that they do. And it's actually going to air this month, this Friday, every month. This Friday coming, it's the fourth Friday of every month. And it's, can you get KPFA down here?
Sure.
If you stand on a really tall thing, maybe. It's on KPFA, which is 94.1 FM. The show comes out at 4 p.m. If you're interested, you can also listen to it online if you have access to the internet. And if you go to kpfa.org, they have live streaming, so you can listen to it that way too. And every month they pick kind of one particular focus, and then they do some interviews, and they do some news stories, and they usually have a prisoner mailbag too. Because one of the things that they really wanted to do was figure out a way to bridge the gap between kind of inside and outside prisons and jails. And right now they reach about 80% of all of the prisons in the state of California with their show. And so they're really able to send stuff in and get stuff back out. And usually they read something that a prisoner's written, or they do shout outs or something like that every single month. And one of the great things that's developed on that show is that there's a group in San Quentin, which is just in San Rafael, on the other side of Oakland, that gets together and does a study group around that show now every month. So they're kind of expanding that. They are also working on, they're also involved in a few coalitions. There's a coalition called Education Not Incarceration, which is really focused on talking about the spending priorities in the state of California and the fact that in Oakland alone, they at one point were talking about shutting down 13 schools. I think they've narrowed it down to something like 5. And yet prisons are taking very, very small hits, if any. The guards maintained their raise last year. We just found out that the guards over the past couple of years hired 1,000 unauthorized employees that they were not budgeted for nor approved for. And there's about an equivalent number of teacher positions open inside the prisons. And as you all probably know, that's one of the first things that gets cut, is any kind of programming. So it's this really odd, you know, priority that the state of California has. They're also involved in a coalition called CURB, I guess, which is focused on shutting down some prisons this year. The California Department of Corrections has said, because of its budget constraints, that it might close down as many as 5 prisons this year. I think that's real optimistic, but that's been the talk. And so there's a group of different anti-prison, anti-PSC groups that got together and strategized around which prisons, you know, they would recommend to make it really real, to give them concrete proposals, and also to highlight the fact that the people who have been named to the commission to talk about which prisons to shut down are all internal people. They're all, you know, wardens and sheriffs, and I think there's a mayor of some town. They're no former prisoners. They're no advocates. There are no legal advocates for prisoners on that board. So it's kind of to do both things, right, to kind of highlight what's not happening that could be happening, and to offer really concrete proposals about how to shut down some of the prisons in a system that's really enormous.
So what are they facing, though? Money?
They have a set of criteria. I'm not part of that coalition. They have a set of criteria that are like where it is, mm-hmm. how old the facility is, who's there.
And how many jobs there are going to be.
I don't know if they figured jobs, but they did figure, I think, capacity in the rest of the system to absorb people. You know, I think they figured a bunch of different kinds of things.
And do you know if there's something with the prisoners that are telling this?
Well, I mean, I think they maintain that a couple things can happen. The California Department of Corrections is also supposed to be paroling up to 15,000 people early over the next year and a half. Again, that's fiction currently, so I don't want people to get too excited about that. But, you know, I think what they're saying is the only way to actually reduce the prison budget is to reduce the number of prisoners in the system, right? There are lots of people who could be eligible for parole. There are lots of people who could be eligible for compassionate release. They say that the system is overcrowded to the gills. We keep hearing from prisoners, oh, they shuffle us around when people come. They stick us all in gym beds when, you know, people come to check out the facilities. So I think, you know, it's, like I said, I'm not involved in that coalition, so I don't want to misspeak for them, but I think it really is a combination of different kinds of strategies to get people out and to actually make the department use its capacity. And then the other thing that they're working on up in Oakland is there's a new city ordinance that a group of people up there is trying to fight. It's a nuisance eviction ordinance, which is based on one that they passed down in Los Angeles a little while ago. And essentially what it does is for pretty much any crime that involves any kind of violence or drugs, it compels private landlords to evict their tenants. And so you may know about the public housing one strike where if you are found to be in possession or if you could be found to be selling drugs, not even on the premises, and you are connected in some way to a household in public housing, the entire household can be evicted. So it can be a guest that can show up at your house with something, get arrested for it, and the entire household can be evicted because the idea is that you should know who's in your house and be able to control them, right? And there was a landmark case up in Oakland, the Rucker case, that went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court upheld it, and so now that's policy, federal policy. The nuisance eviction ordinance somewhat applies that to private residences. So whereas before, if you lived in a private residence, your landlord could decide what they wanted to do, you know, about you, if you were using drugs, if you were getting in fights, if you had a gun, you know, whatever that situation might be. And what they would like to do is to legally compel landlords to evict their tenants. In the case of drug charges, those do not have to be on the premises. So if you are found somewhere else in Oakland using drugs, they can, the idea is that they could start the process of eviction. Because they found, apparently, that in Los Angeles, landlords were pretty much just ignoring the eviction notices, Oakland wants to attach to it a lien on the property if you don't proceed with the eviction. So right now we're in the process of trying to fight that, which I think is a really, really enormous deal. So there's a public hearing coming up about that, so we're trying to mobilize the people around that and then try to figure out how to stop it. And currently there's no due process. One of the things that we just found out, I just found out today, is that it doesn't even have to be the cops that initiate the process. You're a group of concerned citizens could say, you know, we have good reason to believe that this person is dealing drugs at his house. They could write a letter to the city, and that would also trigger the proceedings. And currently there's not a hearing process. There's no due process currently for dealing with this. So if you want to know more about that, I can tell you more about that later. Sacramento is small and struggling and trying to go along little bit by little bit. They are doing a series of film screenings right now, and they're doing some research on taking up a campaign against the Sacramento County Jail, which is a notorious jail in the state. It's one of the worst human rights records of all jails in the state. So they're interested in taking up something around that. They've been doing some education about that. Tons of information, right? So that's how the chapters are set up. The chapters are supported by 5 full-time staffers for the entire country. There are 2 of us out here. I'm out here, and Rose Braz, who some of you might know, is also out here. There are 2 staffers in New York City. There's a Northeast Regional Coordinator who works with all of our chapters in the East Coast. And the former Prisoner and Family Member Coordinator, Pilar Maskey, is also out there. And her job is really to help all of the chapters develop good tools for making sure that we're bringing in and our chapters are accessible and hospitable to former prisoners, family members of prisoners. Yeah?
I was wondering, which group was doing the work against the Delano prison?
The Delano 2 prison, that was Oakland. So there are 5 staffers. The last one is Kenyon, and he's in New Orleans. And he deals with he's a Southern Regional Coordinator, so he's a support staff for that person. Some of the local chapters have part-time staff that they've raised money for. So, for instance, New York raised some money to get a part-time staffer in their chapter. Los Angeles raised money to get some part-time staff there. We try to keep ourselves staff and infrastructure light because it takes lots of money to keep offices and to pay staff people and that kind of thing. And we would prefer that what little money we do have goes to the chapters, goes to the organizing work. So that's how that's set up.